Greg Berg is coming up. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills, empowering Carthage students to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/Aspire. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later on in the hour, we're going to be hearing from Stephen Pastis, best known for his comic strip Pearls Before Swine. But in this particular interview, he'll be talking about his wildly popular series of books for young readers called Timmy Failure, a movie version of his first book, Timmy Failure, Mistakes Were Made, is about to be released this weekend on Disney Plus as a film. But first, we'll be talking about a little show called Little Shop of Horrors.
On the 21st day of the month of September, in an early year of a decade not too long before our own, the human race suddenly encountered a deadly threat to its very existence. And this terrifying enemy surfaced, as such enemies often do, in the seemingly most innocent and unlikely of places.
That is the opening to Little Shop of Horrors, book and lyrics by Howard Ashman, music by Alan Menken. And today on the morning show, we're going to be talking with three people who are involved in the production of the Lakeside Players, their production of Little Shop of Horrors, which is about to open tonight and running for the next three weekends. Joe Cardamone is the music director, Katie Gray is the stage director, and Haley Hutchison is playing the central role of Audrey in this production. We welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Joe, you helped set up this interview, and it's a little crazy to be getting up bright and early to do an interview the morning of opening night, I should think, but you all seem energized and ready to roll. So how has it been going this week?
It's been going really well. In fact, Katie gave everybody last night off. I've told people, I feel like Lakeside is the first theater I've worked with that routinely gives the night before opening off, which is both wonderful and terrifying, you know. yeah. But I think the way things have been going this week, very smoothly. Stuff is ready to go. I think it was beneficial to give everybody a night off to sort of rest and be ready for tonight. So.
Wow. Well, we're glad that you can all be here to talk about this really intriguing show. I will be the first to say, and it won't come as a surprise to anybody who knows me, this is not exactly my kind of show. Although I have seen it. I saw it at the Racine Theater Guild some years ago, and I enjoyed myself sort of in spite of myself. I mean, I enjoyed it a whole lot more than I was sort of led to believe I would. I mostly went out of a sense of kind of civic duty and supporting friends who were in the cast, and actually had a great time. It's probably really important for us right off the bat to kind of spell out for people who have never seen Little Shop of Horrors what this show is about and the ways in which it is not exactly The King and I. So Katie and Joe, say whatever you want to kind of describe what makes this show quite out of the ordinary.
Yeah, so the show is about, I mean, to put it simply, a plant that feeds off of blood. So, I mean, it's kind of out of this world, and it's very surreal, and it's about two people who kind of try to find love in spite of this plant, and maybe because of the plant. And yeah, it's very funny, and it's not historically accurate, because obviously there's no actual, hopefully, man-eating plant.
It's based on a classic, if that's the right word to use, B-movie by Roger Corman, king of the classic B-movies, and sort of interesting historical tidbit, literally was done on the fly. Corman was notoriously cheap. He finished up a movie with two extra days of shooting time budgeted, and essentially on the fly they came up with this movie that they could film in 2 days. It was Jack Nicholson's first screen role, has a small part in the original movie. Where they came up with the idea, I have no idea. I also have no idea why Ashman and Menken picked that particular property to turn into a musical, but they did. It is, like Katie said, it's certainly non-time specific, but the music really, for the most part, has a lot of sort of late 50s, early 60s doo-wop feel. In fact, there's a to sound really pretentious, there's a Greek chorus in the show. It's three street urchins who perform sort of Motowny doo-wop throughout and kind of comment on the action and fill in little bits and pieces in the background. And so it's the music, I keep telling people, is just so much fun. You know, and I think, like you said, even if you may be coming into it skeptically, either because of the subject matter or anything else, I think it's hard not to enjoy this show. You know, there's the test that people always talk about musicals is there something you're going to walk out humming? And there's many songs you'll be able to walk out humming.
For sure. Absolutely for sure. I was noticing when I read up on the show a little bit earlier this morning that it premiered off Broadway, and they weren't, you know, trying to make a joke or anything. There is such a thing as off Broadway, and so that says something about kind of the gestation or genesis of this show.
And in fact, I don't think it made it to Broadway until the early 2000s.
Mm. Oh wow! Okay.
Explain what a typical performance of this is like. I mean, in terms of audience connection with the. What's the action on stage and so on?
I mean, there's obviously, like Joe was saying, the songs are so catchy. I find myself humming usually just one part of a song every day, which I'm sure makes me look very sane. And yeah, I mean, there's some fourth wall breaking. There's a 10-piece band orchestra. So we, you know, there's the music is phenomenal. I think they're just going to come out of there kind of almost rocking and rolling.
Did either of you have a hand in Little Shop of Horrors being chosen for this year's Lakeside Players season?
Yeah, so I'm the vice president for Lakeside Players, so we do, as a board, decide the show, and that was definitely one of the top ones because it is such a good musical. It's a little smaller than the ones we've done in the past, so last year's performance we did Rocky, and the year before that was Rent, so this is a much smaller cast. And then, so we had a little bit of a hand in it, and then, you know, just through kind of thinking very much if I wanted to direct it, then I ended up putting in to direct it. So
very good. So how big a cast again is this?
There's only nine people.
Oh, okay.
Ten if you include the plant, which we always do.
Right. Well, before we talk about the plant, because in and of itself, that's kind of an interesting element in the show, we should make sure that we hear from Haley Hutchison, who is portraying the role of Audrey, who really gets some wonderful music to sing, doesn't she?
Oh, yes. I'm thrilled about all of the songs I have. Yes. This is a really, really fun character to play. She's very different from anything I've ever played before, and she's just hilarious, and I'm really happy that in this show I finally have some funny lines, because I've always played generally very serious characters, or so I'm really happy. Like she said, there's a few times where you get to break the fourth wall and just really look right at the audience while you make them laugh, so that's fun.
Yeah, there's nothing better. So who wants to try to spell out the storyline for Little Shop of Horrors?
So it's about a shop worker named Seymour who is trying to help the shop that he works at, which is on Skid Row, so just kind of in the worst part of town. And he kind of finds this plant, he buys it, and it immediately attracts attention. So it immediately attracts customer attention. The shop gets money, so he tries to find ways to help it grow. He discovers that it eats blood, so he's like, oh, that's an easy thing to do. I'll just keep feeding it blood. he then, you know, it kind of progresses from there, and he tries to do certain things to help the shop, and then also Audrey, because she's in a bad relationship, and it kind of spirals. I don't want to give too much away if people haven't seen the movie, either one of the movies, I guess.
But, you know, even for the people who have seen the movie, there's a nice little surprise in it. It's not exactly the same, so they'll still get something new, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. I've actually never seen that original movie.
Oh, it's great.
Well, so, again, in one of those sort of weird twists, there was an original non-musical movie that then got turned into this Broadway musical, and then there was a filmed version of the musical in the 80s?
Yeah.
86, maybe?
With actually a pretty big name cast. But, yeah, they changed the ending of the show for the movie. So, again, if people only know the movie, the ending is going to be a surprise.
Different, yeah.
So the original show's ending is different from the filmed version ending?
Yes.
Gotcha. All right. I think I have that untangled in my mind. So, Joe, you were saying that this is a fun score. That doesn't necessarily mean it's an easy score. What has the process been like to put this together musically?
It hasn't been terrifically challenging. I think there have certainly been harder shows I've worked on musically, but it's... it's been working on from the actor standpoint or the cast standpoint, trying to nail down harmonies again, particularly with the three doo-wop girls. There's a lot of close three-part harmony in there, and then obviously sort of working on characterization and so forth. From the band standpoint, it has just been an absolute joy. You'll be thrilled to hear that I have a band made up entirely of Carthage alums, and then one current student. And they are just nine of the finest musicians I could possibly be hoping to work with. There's actually two arrangements of the show. There's a five-piece pit, which is bass, guitar, drums, two keyboards, and then there is a ten-piece arrangement, which adds two reeds, two horns, and a second percussionist. And I'm early on, I was pushing Katie, like, we got to do the bigger one. And she was able to persuade the powers to be to spring for that. And I just think those other five performers add so much, having the horns and the reeds. There's a number in there called Mushnik and Son, which I tell people is probably the greatest musical theater clarinet part outside of like Fiddler on the Roof. Sammy Whalen, who's now Sammy Reed, Carthage alum, gets to sort of take the lead in there, and it's just fantastic. And the band has been so amazing to work with.
Well, let's take out the Decca original cast recording and see what all the fuss is about. So this piece again is called Mushnik and Son.
It is, although in that the original recording will have the smaller
Oh,
the smaller pit. So you
Let me take out the other one then and see if I can find it. So explain a little about the context of this particular song.
So the song is where Mr. Mushnick, who owns the flower shop that both Audrey and Seymour work at, kind of realizes that if he doesn't do something to keep Seymour there, he could lose basically the money he's bringing in from Audrey too, which is the name of the plant. And so he offers to adopt him.
All right. So here we go with this song called Mushnick and Son. And this is from the new Broadway cast recording of Little Shop of Horrors.
He'll think about it. He'll think about it.
I don't like that guy, Mr. Mushnick. And you should hear the way he talks to Audrey.
Gott in Himmel, no, the kid just said he'd mull it over.
No wonder she looks so unhealthy. It's enough to make you sick.
If he left me, if Seymour left me, why then I'd be right back where I started, which was broken, starving.
Sweet and good and beautiful as she is, she deserves a prince, not a sadistic creep like him.
Close to bankrupt.
What a louse.
Beset, befuddled, and bereft. That's what I'd be if Seymour left.
He's a disgrace to the dental profession.
Seymour!
Sir?
Seymour. How would you like to be my son? How would you like to be my own adopted boy? I never liked him much before, but count the cash that's in the drawer. I got no choice, I'm much too poor, say yes.
What for?
Seymour, I want to be your dad. I want to see you climbing up my family tree. I used to think you left the stench, but now I see that you're a mensch, so I'm proposing be my son. Mushnick and Son. Sounds great. Three words with the ring of fate. So say incorporate with me. A florist's dream come true. Mushnick and his boy chick, you. What business will do for FTD?
That is a great song. There's a bit of Mushnick and Son from the musical Little Shop of Horrors. We're talking today with Joe Cardamone, Katie Gray, and Haley Hutchison, who are all part of the production of the Lakeside Players, production of Little Shop of Horrors that opens tonight and runs for the next three weekends at the Rhodey Opera House in downtown Kenosha. So, Katie, logistically, what challenges has this musical posed to you as stage director?
I mean, the number one challenge is the plant, for sure. So it is a man-eating plant. So we had to get a plant puppet large enough to actually eat someone. So that was fun. So we were actually able to find a, I'll say local, I mean, they're in Appleton, a community theater company called the Freedom Area Community Theater that actually made the plant for their production. So they rented it to us, which was great because that is, from what I kind of read, the hardest part of anyone doing this show. I think
right.
When we did it last time, I think we got the plant from Minnesota or Iowa, and it was ginormous. And it was just because that was the plant we could get.
Right. And so it might be a plant that doesn't necessarily fit your stage
Absolutely.
Well or fit the rest of your production all that well.
Yeah. And so this one was great, and we have a really good puppeteer who has, I think, enjoyed himself immensely. So. And, yeah, so that's been, like, that is the number one challenge. I think everything else has been, I mean, compared to that, fairly normal for a musical theater.
Right. Haley Hutchison, you are the character of Audrey. Explain how Audrey figures in this plot, and then we'll hear a little of your big song.
Well, as Katie mentioned before, she starts out in kind of a rocky relationship, I guess, to say the least. And Seymour, who's, you know, the hero of the whole show, he does what he can to save her from this relationship. So she kind of, I don't know, goes from like battered and abused to loved and cherished at the end, but which she was always loved and cherished by Seymour. But it's an interesting role to play. And she's very important in the shop too, because Mushnick and Seymour are they don't always get along, but Audrey, I think, is kind of like the middle ground.
Right. Seems to me that the character of Audrey is really crucial to the magic of this show, and that if you somehow excerpted her out of it, the show would feel very, very different and we would miss her presence.
Well, it's a lot of the motivation for why Seymour does a lot of what he does. You know, he's in love with her. So I think that it really would be different if she wasn't in there. What would be his motivation for doing any of this at all? But yeah, I'm very excited to play Audrey.
Yeah, I think she's definitely the heart of the show. Like, she's definitely, like, the one who's, like, she's very sweet and, you know, definitely wants everyone to kind of get along and wants to make everyone happy. So, yeah, it's definitely the heart of the show.
Right. And certainly the song she sings, Suddenly Seymour, is quite lovely. Who wants to set the stage for when and why this song gets sung in the show?
Oh, gosh. I guess this is the big turning point in the show for Audrey and Seymour. They kind of always have a relationship and I think always have those feelings, but they never admitted it. And this is the part in the show where they finally say, okay, we're going to do this. We are a thing now. Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah, very important to the end of the show, too.
Very good. And, Joe, I should think it must be a real pleasure to be on the podium for a musical moment like this.
It is. I mean, it's certainly one of the great songs of the show. And again, it's between the two, well, really five, because the girls get to fill in at the end, performers on stage and the band. I think it's just it really comes together really nicely.
Here's a little bit of Suddenly Seymour, sung by the character of Audrey, and this is from the original Broadway cast recording of Little Shop of Horrors.
Lift up your head, wash off your mascara. Here, take my Kleenex, wipe that lipstick away. Show me your face, clean as the morning. I know things were bad, but now they're okay. Suddenly, Seymour is standing beside you. Don't need no makeup, don't have to pretend. Suddenly, Seymour is here to provide you sweet understanding. Seymour's your
nobody brother. Ever treated me kindly. Daddy left early, Mama was poor. I'd meet a man and I'd follow him blindly. He'd snap his fingers, me, I'd say sure. Suddenly Seymour is standing beside me. He don't give me
till forever. Tell me the bad times are clean washed away.
Please understand that it's still strange and frightening. The losers like I've been, it's so hard to say. Suddenly Seymour,
suddenly Seymour,
he purified me.
He purified you.
Suddenly Seymour,
Suddenly Seymour, which is one of the best-known songs and maybe one of the best songs from this musical score Little Shop of Horrors. We're talking today with Joe Cardamone, Katie Gray, and Haley Hutchison about the Lakeside Players production of Little Shop of Horrors, which opens tonight. So, Katie, you really gave the cast off last night.
I did. I tried to do that for a couple reasons. One, I think it just helps vocally when they can take a night off because they're rehearsing usually from, if we do Tech Sunday, which we didn't actually have to do because we started Tech last week, they would be rehearsing from Monday to Thursday and then performing Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And that's a lot. That's a lot, mm-hmm. I think, physically and a lot probably emotionally.
Right.
Especially this season when so many things are going around.
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning of the show, thank God it was at the beginning, everyone was like, I can't come in tonight. I have the flu. I have strep throat. And I'm like, well, at least it's the beginning of the show.
Right.
Everything was going so well. I don't think I've ever been so comfortable. I was talking to Joe about this. I don't think I've ever been so comfortable going into the show. Like, I'm so like, oh, yeah, we have everything going on. We have everything set that I'm like, what am I clearly missing? I'm missing something because I'm way too relaxed.
Yeah, this should be harder than it is.
And I'm sure I won't be, like 7 o'clock tonight, I'll be a wreck. But
right. So your goal as director, it sounds like, is if you possibly can to get things to a place where the cast at least can have that night before off.
Yes. And then, you know, starting tonight, I mean, it's not my show anymore. It's their show. You know, it's their, you know, it's on them. So that sounds really bad, but
no
yeah,
pressure.
I mean, I've done what I can do. So, and I'm really excited because I'm excited for them to get in front of an audience for the first time and to hear the laughs that aren't mine and to hear, you know, applause that aren't mine. So I think that's what I'm most excited about.
And at the risk of sounding really full of myself, I sort of think of myself as at least one of Katie's mentors.
Yeah,
because
no, that's true.
She AD'd for me 3 times before she started directing on her own. And certainly my philosophy, and I think hers as well, is clearly the most important thing is a good product. But you know, just behind that is that people have a good experience. And I think...
The people in the show.
The people in the show, you know. And I think that's always really been the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that people who are new will want to come back, will tell other people to, you know, to the, you know, what a fun time they had. And we have a number of people in the show that haven't been on the Lakeside stage before, right?
Yeah. Yeah, or are really new, like Haley. So she was in, excuse me, Miracle. In December, and then that was your first show there, and so this is you just went right into another show.
Yeah, it was. I had actually heard so much about the two of them that's actually what made me audition. Besides loving the movie, but I had heard that they were so amazing. I was like, well, I want to do another one, I guess.
Yeah, very good. Well, and I agree with you, Joe. That it's one thing to put out a great product for an audience to enjoy, but if your cast and crew are kind of battered and bloodied and weary and wanting never to be in another show because it's been such a wrenching, taxing experience, that there's something wrong with that equation.
Well, and you know, somebody who also, you know, is involved in community theater, I mean, you know that one bad experience, whether it is an audience member or as a cast/crew member, you know, can take years to recover from. You
absolutely.
Know, if somebody goes and tells people, God, that was a nightmare, you don't want to do that.
Yeah, don't want to sing in a Greg Berg show or a Joe Cardamone show.
Yeah.
But
I mean, but, even like I've had experiences where by the end of the show, I'm so exhausted, I don't even want to see the theater.
Hmm.
And at this point, I see the theater more than I see my home. So,
And happily so from the sound of it.
Oh, yeah, I love it. I mean, it's my second home. I've been there for most of my life, so... Yeah.
In fact, I should just throw out, only because it's a fun bit of trivia, this is the second time, at least in relatively recent memory, that Lakeside has done the show. Maybe it's done it more than that, but certainly the second. We did it in 2007, and when we did it then, my wife and I actually played the leads. We're Seymour and Audrey.
Oh, really?
And Katie's dad was the director.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
wow.
So, and they did it with a piano and a guitar. So when I was talking to him yesterday and saying, oh, we have a 10-piece, and this is our... He's like, I hate you.
Oh, because that's all they had
that's
in the pit.
That's all they had.
All
that's
was...
all,
wow.
Because it was one of the very first musicals that Lakeside did. So
yeah.
He
wow.
likes to he likes to pretend to take credit for the fact that we can have a musical theater program now. And I'm like,
right.
I'm thinking Joe had a lot more to do with that.
Yeah.
But all right.
So, well, things are on the rise. It's good to see. So, tonight is opening night. Haley, you're in the cast. You're ready to roll to be Audrey?
Yes, I am. Slightly nervous, but it just hit me today. I felt very, very good. And then today, you know, family and friends are telling me that they're coming. I'm like, oh, gosh. Oh, no.
People are going to watch it now.
Yeah.
Well, I think they're going to enjoy themselves thoroughly. So if people are interested in getting more information and or purchasing tickets for this three-weekend run of Little Shop of Horrors, what do they do?
They can go to Rhode Center. That's R-H-O-D-E, center spelled normally, .org. The box office also opens an hour to an hour and a half prior to the show, and they can get tickets at the box office.
All right. Very good. Well, Katie Gray, Joe Cardamone, Haley Hutchison, we wish you and all of your colleagues a very successful run with this intriguing musical called Little Shop of Horrors. And we appreciate you joining us today on the morning show to talk about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Part two of the morning show is coming up in just a moment here on WGTD at 8:40. Finale to Little Shop of Horrors. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. The time is exactly 8:42. To finish out today's morning show, I want to replay for you a portion of a conversation that I recorded back in 2015 with cartoonist Stephen Pastis. The occasion of our most recent conversation was not to talk about his award-winning comic strip, Pearls Before Swine, but rather to talk about the then newly published book called Timmy Failure, Mistakes Were Made, an absolutely hilarious book intended for young readers, telling about the adventures and mostly misadventures of a wannabe private detective named Timmy. The reason I want to replay a portion of this conversation today is because Disney has just produced a film version of Timmy Failure, Mistakes Were Made, which is about to premiere on Disney+. Here's a portion of my conversation with Stephen Pastis explaining where the idea for Timmy Failure began.
The idea actually generated, believe it or not, from a literary agent in New York whose mom was a fan of Pearls. And she told her son about me, I guess, and he looked at Pearls and liked it and emailed me and said, would you ever be interested in doing one of these books? You know, I call them Wimpy Kid books. Technically, it's called a middle-grade illustrated novel, but Jeff Kinney and Wimpy Kid really pioneered the trail for this type of book. And when I say this type of book, I mean, you know, part drawing, part writing. It's about 50-50. And so I said, yeah, sure, I'll try it. He said, I just need 70 pages to show to publishers. So I gave him 70 pages, and he shopped it around to publishers. And lo and behold, there were 10 different ones who wanted to publish it. So it went to something called a book auction. And if you're the writer, that's definitely a good thing.
No kidding. That would be a lot of fun versus sitting forlornly by a quiet telephone waiting for somebody to be interested.
Yes, much better.
Tell us kind of about the nuts and bolts of the book taking shape. I mean, even this preliminary 70 pages that you turned in, which must have been good for all the interest that it generated. But I mean, in terms of kind of that split between illustrations and writing and so on, take us inside the process by which this book began to take shape.
Yeah, so the first thing I needed was a subject matter, and the one I wanted to play with was this idea of kids as detectives, because in every book I had ever read in that genre, you know, whether it be Encyclopedia Brown or the Hardy Boys, the kids are always so clever, much more clever than I am. And I thought, what if you played around in that genre, but the kid was not smart at all and could not solve any mystery whatsoever? And that made me laugh. And then I thought, what if that same kid was simultaneously pretty pretty arrogant? And I thought that would be fun, because he'd have such a big blind spot. He'd think he was one thing, but he was really another. So then doing, you know, an animal strip like I do, I thought it'd be fun to give him an animal partner. So I gave him a polar bear who Timmy uses, to keep his books and be his accountant. And, of course, it's just a polar bear, so all he wants to do is eat from the garbage can and sleep. But for me, that was just fun. So I did that, and the way I went about writing it was to pretty much the same way I write the strip. Very odd, but I just turn on music really loud and sit in my room and see what ideas come to me. I outline very little of it, mostly because I just want to be surprised by what happens next. And I just tried to keep it exciting for myself. You know, I think that's always the key to anything creative you do, to entertain yourself first.
Right. I wonder how much you thought consciously about making this funny for a young person. If that felt at all sort of intimidating. I mean, somebody who's appears to be very easily, effortlessly funny day after day in Pearls Before Swine. Did this feel like a different kind of funny, at least in the beginning, as you started out?
You know what the thing is? This is my theory on it anyways. If you write to make a kid laugh specifically, you will inevitably find yourself writing down to that kid. And kids know when somebody has done that. So I didn't want to do that. I wrote like I always write, which is to just make myself laugh. Now, fortunately, in my case, I think I am somehow an 11-year-old kid. So when I write and hopefully entertain myself, it seems to translate well to kids in that age range. So to me, I'm almost writing to my peers, like, oddly enough. So it wasn't. I would never do that, because I wouldn't know how to make another age group laugh. The only laugh I know is my own, and I just make myself laugh. And fortunately for me, that seems to fit that age group. So I guess it's a good thing that I never really grew up.
We're speaking with Stefan Pastis, and we are talking about a brand new book that's just been published called Timmy Failure, Mistakes Were Made. And it does indeed tell the story of this young boy named Timmy Failure, who fancies himself to be a very, very fine detective. I mean, certainly the best detective agency in the town, probably the state, perhaps the nation. And he tells us that more than once. As I read this book, actually, it reminded me of a couple of books I read a long time ago. I mean, as a grade schooler, so back in the late 60s, early 70s. And I'm not presuming that you would have read these books. Some of our listeners might remember one book called Double Trouble for Rupert, another one called Triple Trouble for Rupert. The one thing that the scenario is not at all the same. But what your book reminds me of a little bit is kind of an earnest speaking style, the style of a young person trying to be correct as they speak and using especially good language. The way in which, you know, if you an earnest student gets up in front of a class and gives a book report, maybe tries to throw in some big letters or big words or tries to convey some impressive ideas, and these really funny books from decades ago, Triple Trouble for Rupert, were kind of written in that style with Rupert, yes, the teenage narrator. But so in a sense, there was nothing sloppy about the words.
Right.
And there's something about the way Timmy Failure expresses himself that I also find really intriguing versus some young person who might write in or speak in kind of lackadaisical fashion. I think I'd get really tired of that very quickly, and I would think you would get tired of writing that too.
I think so. You know, I never read those, but my model was a book, which I think is the best comedy ever written. It was called, I think it won the Pulitzer for fiction. It was called A Confederacy of Dunces, written in 1979 by John Kennedy Toole. And it was, you know, it's a real overweight guy who lives with his mom, unemployed. But, man, he thinks he's the savior of the world. And he talks in that sort of highfalutin language. And I love that. And I love Timmy uses a lot of insults that you see in the late 19th century that, like, Twain used, like, you know, scalawag and buffoon. And, like, I just love those words. I just think it's funny. You know, for me, it's all the key to a character in a comedy. This is what I think anyways, is to just make the difference between who they are and who they think they are as wide apart as possible. You know, that's what I call the blind spot. And I think when you have that, you've got something. You know, if you think about it, like with Laurel and Hardy, you know, they didn't think of themselves as down-and-out losers. I mean, certainly Hardy thought of himself as someone who would, you know, strike it rich at any moment and is just held back by the skinny guy. And, of course, you look at him, and he's not smart at all. And or even like Charlie Chaplin. Charlie Chaplin is a bum, but he tries to dress up like a gentleman. And I think it's that dichotomy that, whether you realize it or not, is what you laugh at. Mm.
When you were talking about certain insults and so on, and how Timmy Failure seems to be drawing on some venerable ways to insult somebody, I think, for instance, of when he talks about this old crabby teacher that he can't stand, old man Crocus, and you have Timmy saying, he stands at his beloved whiteboard for 6 hours a day to tell me things that could bore the fur off of a squirrel.
Then I think I show the hairless squirrel.
Oh, yes, you absolutely do, absolutely. A bewildered squirrel sitting in a pile of his own fur. You go on to say, old man Crocus is 187 years old. He smells, and he is bent over like he's got a sack of potatoes hanging from his forehead. And you go on to say, that would be useful if I were making French fries, but I'm not. I'm building a detective agency empire, and there is nothing in my classroom that is going to help me get there. And of course, this really touches on what a lot of young people feel a lot of the time, like so much of the world around them and so much of what they're forced to do has nothing to do with what's most important to them.
Yeah, right. You know, I was one of those kids in school that I did really well, but boy, was I easily bored and easily distracted. And so I think that's why when I write, you know, I don't want to bore those kids. I want to entertain that little kid that I was. Not a lot of, you know, unnecessary description. Just get to the joke, you know, as quickly as I can, keep their attention. I write so that that kid that I was would not be bored reading this.
Absolutely. I wonder if, yeah, I asked you earlier, did you think a lot about purposefully making this funny for a young reader? And ultimately the answer was no. On the other hand, did you think very much about making this funny on a couple of different levels? Because I think a lot of us are aware of books that only a kid would find funny, and you know, and parents just go out of their minds with boredom reading these books aloud, or even to themselves. They wouldn't do it in a million years, versus those books that are delightful and funny no matter how old you are. Were you conscious of that concern at all?
I was conscious of that. In fact, the titles of the chapters are something that only the parents would get the reference. There are, like, one of the chapters, I think, was You May Find Yourself Behind the Wheel of a Large Automobile, which is the title of a Talking Heads song. There are a few Bob Dylan songs that are the titles. So the titles were sort of my nod to parents reading it. And also, you know, there's other things like that only a parent might get. For example, the title of the book, which is Mistakes Were Made. Well, that was something I think that was said by Alexander Haig during the Iran-Contra gate.
Right.
So I just think it's funny to get that in there. Or, for example, there's a moment in the second book, the one that comes out next year, where Timmy's mom rifles through his stuff, and Timmy says, "At long last, have you no sense of decency?" Which is a line from the McCarthy hearings.
Yeah, right.
So I thought, boy, how fun would it be to get that line in there? So, yeah, I am conscious of that. I think it's sort of fun. And then, you know, the other thing I thought to myself is why be limited to just kids? I mean, what would be wrong with somebody my age picking up this book and getting something out of it? Why not, you know, can a book like that cross over? Why not? So, yeah, I was conscious of that.
Hmm. One of the most interesting relationships, really, is between Timmy Failure and his mom, who, of course, doesn't begin to understand what any of this is really about. And right. and Timmy believes, rightly or wrongly, that he's managing to do a lot of this without her being even aware of it in the slightest. But I also kind of appreciate the moments when Timmy is trying to understand his mother's seeming cluelessness. There's a moment where you say, "I don't think she," meaning his mom, "means to be misguided. I think it's the stress. She works full-time at a stationery store, and it doesn't pay super well, so she worries a lot. I suspect that has something to do with what's been wrong with her lately. Fortunately for her, she gave birth to a genius who will one day save the entire Failure clan."
He sure doesn't lack for ego, does he?
No, he really, really doesn't. We should probably talk about some of the other interesting characters that that populate this book, including some of the other young people who are memorable characters in their own right.
Yeah, well, his enemy in the book is another detective who, unlike Timmy, is good. Her name is Karina Karina, and she's in his class. And by the way, Karina Karina is another Dylan song title. But Karina Karina, he so despises that he refuses to show her face in the book. So every time she appears, he blacks it out with a big black box, almost like you'd see someone in the witness protection program to block her identity. So there's her. And I think what's interesting about her is she doesn't know Timmy's alive. She does not feel the same way back towards him. Towards him, she just thinks, you know, that's this weird kid in my class. But he is all consumed with her. So I don't know. That just intrigued me to have an antagonist in a book who doesn't know that the protagonist is alive. So that was one character. Then there's his best friend, Rollo Tukas, kind of a big kid who is obsessed with grades. Who else do I have? There's the librarian, whose name is Flo. But Flo is a man, and he's a gigantic, scary biker-looking fellow. So I broke the librarian stereotype a little bit.
And don't forget the girl who smells like a tangerine.
Oh, yeah, Molly Moskins, who's completely in love with Timmy, and Timmy is oblivious to that. And, her name is Molly Moskins. She has mismatched pupils. One is bigger than the other. She talks too much, and she smells like a tangerine. Yes, that's right.
Right.
Sounds so strange when I describe it all.
Stephen Pastis is the creator of the Timmy Failure books, and the first of those books, Timmy Failure, Mistakes Were Made, is about to premiere on Disney Plus as a new film. Stephen Pastis is also responsible for the award-winning comic strip Pearls Before Swine. This weekend for the Morning Show podcast edition, I will be playing this interview in its entirety. That will be tomorrow on the podcast edition of the Morning Show. And on Sunday, I'll be sharing an interview from more than 20 years ago that I recorded with a distinguished member of the Carthage faculty for many years, Dr. Irene Kramer, who was one of the most important figures in creating the model of immersion study in foreign language. And you'll hear that interview with Dr. Irene Kramer talking about the wonders of studying foreign language on Sunday's podcast of The Morning Show. Monday, I'll be speaking with Kenosha author Michael Schumacher about his latest book, Allen Ginsberg, South American Journals, January to July 1960. And next Tuesday, from the archives, my interview with Isabel Wilkerson, the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, which describes the massive